Darren Kaster. You are listening to the Green Majority, Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On this week's show, we've got some fun for you. I've been sort of teasing for the past several weeks that I had a feature that I wanted to play that we hadn't yet used. I'm going to actually finally play that one today. That was Jonathan Trent Energy from Floating Algal Pods. What's really, really neat about that one is that that's actually a project that NASA's been working on that they are actually interested in just giving away for free. He describes that a little bit at the end, but it's sort of this idea where they've basically developed this what could have been easily a proprietary technology to develop vast amounts of energy on offshore, on the top of water, that would have minimal environmental impacts, generate lots of energy, totally avoid fossil fuels, and they just want to give the plans to somebody. Really cool. So we'll hear from that, but that's actually at the very end of the show. We're going to start right at the beginning. We've got Alana Westwood, who attended this Canadian Youth Climate Coalition delegation to COP18. So we're going to be talking to her about what's been happening there and just kind of wrap up COP18. And then after that as well, I've got one I also recorded a couple of weeks back we've been saving as well. We're going to use that. So after we talk about Doha with Alana Westwood, we're going to be hearing from Andrea Reeks. Andrea Reeks is the general manager at Toronto's Patagonia, which is the Toronto location of a clothing store. We do like talking to retailers every once in a while and manufacturers. And, you know, we talked to these burger guys a little while ago. But this one seemed a little bit special. We saw that they had some sort of thing, and, you know, there's lots of people have, they get power from Bullfrog Power, or they do this, or they have paperless offices. That's really neat. Patagonia really seems to have gone to the kind of next level as far as integrating environmental concerns into their business plan. So we're going to hear from her second, and then, as I said, Jonathan Trent with Floating Energy from Floating Algal Pods will wrap up the program. However, we're going to get started. Hopefully I have Alana on the line. Are you there?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. So you were in COP in Doha, actually. I forgot to double check the area code you gave us.
Yeah, I just got back 2 days ago from Qatar, and COP18 has now wrapped up to the disappointment of the climate justice community. But
now I think that before I even let you go any further, I think that's a really good spot to clarify something. The disappointment compared to what we all would have hoped to happen, or what realistically could have been expected to happen? In what way were you disappointed?
Well, I think there were some really interesting developments at COP18 in terms of developing nations, especially the least developed countries, the small island states, and those most threatened by the devastating impacts of climate change, really taking a stand, especially led by the Philippines with the devastation of Typhoon Bopha. The least developed countries came together in a way that certainly I'd never seen before, and gave quite a bit of hope that perhaps they weren't going to stand for this. They weren't going to stand for the bullying tactics of the big polluters. Ultimately, under political pressure, we didn't get as strong of a deal as we would have liked, but there were some signs of hope that there might be some change and some fairness and equity building into these deals.
Talk a little bit about, I've heard mentioned in several places, the Doha Gateway. What are they talking about with that when they're talking about Doha Gateway?
Essentially, Gateway, although it really, Doha, unfortunately, is a gateway to a warmer world. No binding commitments were made, but the way it is being framed by the UNFCCC is that it's a gateway towards a new deal. So that 2020 will have a new deal that brings in major emitters that is binding, something like Kyoto, but with more teeth. And so Doha is being framed as a gateway to move us on the path towards that new deal. Whether or not it actually makes any progress is doubtful in my mind.
So this, I mean, just to be kind of flippant for a moment, this kind of reminds me of an episode of The Simpsons that I remember where the two teachers are arguing on stage and go, all right, let's just agree to disagree. And the both parties go, I don't agree to that. And neither do I. And like, is there any real sense in your kind of opinion, was there any real sense, like obviously there wasn't progress as far as we got a deal, but do you sort of accept what a lot of the headlines that are coming back was that at least there was some groundwork laid for a deal, or are we just stalling, in your opinion?
I think it is a lot of stalling. There was a serious lack of ambition in the developed world this year. A lot more could have been done, but really there's been a ton of reluctance, and Canada's been such a bad example in this, pulling out of Kyoto first, not committing to any more financing for those hit hardest by climate change, who don't have, you know, the social and economic support to deal with this. And Canada's bad example is now being followed by other countries like New Zealand, Japan, the U.S. And I think that this lack of ambition is really troubling. But as the situation gets more urgent, as developing nations wake up with things like Superstorm Sandy, there may start to be some more movement forward in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I, as you can already tell, I'm a fan of analogies, but it's kind of like somebody's house of, you know, an apartment building being on fire and the tenants arguing over who's going to pay the water bill to put it out after.
Absolutely.
Okay, we can probably worry about these little details later. It's kind of more important. But like, as far as different countries acting and that sort of thing, I mean, I have no problem picking on Canada. I think there's lots to pick on Canada for. As you said, they got lots of tongue-in-cheek awards for being the best/worst at the conferences. They do pretty much every year, or at least that's been the trend for the past few years. But they certainly weren't the only ones sort of not playing well with others. Do you have any insight on as to Russia's actions as well? And their sort of sticking point seemed to be the surplus or issue of surplus emissions.
Yeah, well, Russia was a really interesting case. Russia tried to block the deal in the end, and yet the current president at COP just kind of gaveled through the deal anyway in about 3 minutes, independent of this block, and Russia was sort of left there with their hands up going, what just happened? I just blocked this. How can you do this? But there was a big issue around hot air, the carryover of carbon credits from the first period of the Kyoto Protocol to the second period, and Russia was somewhat obstructionist when it came to that, because basically what carrying these credits over would do would allow major polluters to buy more carbon credits and keep polluting if these were carried over into the new period. But they certainly weren't the only ones. The big surprise pariah this year was New Zealand, who won. They tied with Canada for the colossal fossil of most fossil awards. And their first fossil award, they actually won for being worse than Canada. New Zealand may have been the new Canada.
So as far as the negotiations themselves, I think the process and all the kind of protocol this and minister that and whatever, I think for your average population, I mean, even as somebody who's terribly interested in the issue of climate change, I have to admit that conferences and stuff like this and official delegations and all that stuff seems both a little bit boring and it's hard to sort of attach it to actual action. Do you feel like the public at all is invested in these sorts of topics outside of the kind of sort of a few niche interested people? Are things like COP something that really actually connects to people for real change? Do you think that, you know, Canadians are looking to our Canadian delegation to solve these problems, or is this sort of, you know, something taking place at one level that doesn't really connect to action at the other?
Yeah, not anymore. I don't think there was a lot of hope around Kyoto and Copenhagen, but we've seen this process fail us over and over. We've seen it fail to produce binding commitments. It's turned into posturing. It's turned into even sort of ways for developed nations to take advantage of developing nations. And people are losing faith in this process. And as people lose faith in it, the same thing happens in that the negotiators and the government, they see it as an economic thing, as a political thing, and not what it really is. I think the negotiator from Nauru really brought it home when he said, "We're not discussing how comfortably your people will live. We're discussing if our people will live." And I think that these high-level international negotiations, not only are they completely obfuscated and confusing, but they really take the humanity out of it, that there's people suffering, that there's species being lost, that we are in a climate catastrophe right now, and all of this bickering about sort of economic implications really is an aside to the fact that we all need to take action, and we all need to take action immediately, regardless of the finger pointing for who's responsible.
I have one final question on that point for you before we have to go, which is that I'm aware of the fact that a lot of the time when we're in negotiations, whether we could be talking about international climate negotiations or we could be talking about two companies negotiating for a business deal or any sort of negotiation, a lot of the time what takes place is that people take positions they don't necessarily actually hold for the sake of bargaining for something they want that doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with the deal. So, for instance, you and I might agree to trade my cherry cola for your grape cola, but I may not actually want the grape cola. It's because I know that I want to trade the grape cola to my buddy or something like that. Is there a sense at all that the actual holdups in these negotiations have to do with sort of people not actually kind of negotiating in good faith, and that they're sort of holding out for side deals and side bets, and that that's what's slowing down the process? Or do you think the countries actually can't agree on the issues at hand?
I think, even Environment Minister Peter Kent acknowledged the severity and the seriousness of climate change, and then Canada brought nothing to the table, really. So you're right, ultimately. It's being used as a political bargaining chip and not really a tool to achieve a better world for everyone, which is a shame because I really, speaking to the negotiators, all the other delegates, youth delegates, official parties, people know how serious it is, and they want to make it better, but unfortunately, sort of the political gamesmanship and the posturing takes over the process, and it becomes not about climate change at all, but, sort of these colonial remnants of finger-pointing and arm-waving and blame-laying, and suddenly we're not talking about the climate anymore, and we're not getting real progress to averting the greatest crisis we've ever seen.
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today, but thank you very much for joining us, Alana Westwood, who is the Research Director and Volunteer Coordinator at the Food Label Movement and was also part of the Canadian Youth Delegation's, Canadian Climate Youth Coalition's Youth Delegation this year to Doha COP18. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so we're going to take a brief music break, and then I'll be back to chat with Kevin Farmer a little bit right before we hear from Andrea Weeks of Patagonia Toronto. And then we're going to hear very end of the program, of course, Jonathan Trent Energy from Floating Algal Ponds, which is something I'm super interested in as well. Hopefully everybody else is, but I think it's pretty darn neat. So stay tuned right after this music break.
to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Mad world. Mad
world. All right, and we're back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I also want to just thank, of course, DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight blog, and would like to say happy birthday to her. That Mad World by Tara McLean was a song requested by her. Of course, she gets to pick all the music every week, but I played that one first, and I made sure that I played it because that was her request. Tara McLean, if you happen to be listening for any reason, I can't imagine that you would be. Apparently, Amber wants you to sing happy birthday to her, just saying, you know, I call your mom, something. I don't know. Kevin Farmer's in the studio. We're going to chat with him just for a quick second and then get on to our second interview of the day. But first of all, how are you doing, Kevin?
I'm good, thanks. Got the definition of a nagging cold, but otherwise I'm fine.
Alrighty. So among our many news roles today, there was a story coming out of London, England, talking about Environment Secretary Owen Paterson Monday calling for genetically modified food to be grown widely and to be supported by government, and that opposition to it was, quote, complete nonsense. Now, I do understand that there's quite a vigorous anti-GM movement in the UK. I'm also aware of the fact that GM food is heavily regulated in Europe. Do you think that this is, Kevin, a sort of a shift in opinion, or is this just a government official maybe not realizing the backlash that this comment could grab? What do you take from this?
This person is just grossly uninformed. You know, on the one hand, human beings have been performing genetic modification of food crops for thousands of years through natural selection and sort of an accelerated natural selection through breeding practices and hybridization and so on and so forth. These practices we know are safe because we've been using them for thousands of years. What's happening now should not be confused for the kind of benign genetic modification that farmers have used since the agricultural revolution. We're talking about now often transgenic genetic manipulation, where genes found in a completely different species, like a fish or a shellfish or something, are transplanted into another organism to confer some supposed benefit. But without going too deeply into the topic, genes behave based on their environment, and it's kind of unpredictable to say I'm going to take a gene out of this organism, splice it into this organism, and predict how it's going to behave. And the problem with this is that it begs for the precautionary principle. How do you put the genie back in the bottle if you create an actual Frankenfood? Like, if you create something that's harmful to the environment.
But you don't mean that it like stands up and has stitches on its neck.
If genetic modification produces a genuine disaster, how do you put the genie back in the bottle? You can't. This isn't, I mean, even an oil spill you can clean up to some extent, but how do you recall bad genes once they've been released into the environment and they start contaminating other organisms, and these genes get passed along, to a large extent, the effect that these new plants are having on insects is not well studied, and we need insects. You know, we don't want to mess with insects. Insects are nature's mechanics; they keep the world running. And in particular, bees. We don't want to mess with bees because they literally are responsible for producing a third of all of our food crops.
Again, it's the number. I wish I had the number memorized because I keep using this approximate statistic. But I'm aware of the sort of order of magnitude that, specifically with your example of bees, which I really like, which is that the economic value of bees is, say, just for the sake of argument, $8 billion. I'm just making up a number. Mm-hmm. But the ratio is roughly correct, even though I'm making up the numbers, is that the actual human value. So people say, okay, so it's worth, you know, $8 billion or $8 million or $800 million, whatever. Great. But that's the value that the bees contribute to. That's not the replacement cost of the bees. If we lost the bees, it would be something like 10 times that.
Yeah.
If we lost all the bees, yes, they produce, say, again, for the sake of the example, 8 million dollars to replace them. No, no, it's like 80 million or 80 billion to replace the services that they do if we lose them all. It's a serious problem.
Losing bees would be a civilization altering event. It's worth a bit of hyperbole to try and get the point across. We just could not live the way we're living now without bees. They like I said, they produce a third of our food. That food would be gone. It requires bees for pollination. And, you know, unless every person on Earth would suddenly get a summer job going out and pollinating plants, we actually couldn't do it. It just couldn't be done. We couldn't replace bees in any way, shape, or form. And we would see a third of our crops disappear. So back to genetically modified organisms, we're playing with things that we, you know, really don't understand. And especially when it comes to trans-species genetic modification.
Right. So doing things like putting amphibian DNA in apples reminds me of Jurassic Park, doesn't it? A little bit.
Yeah, a little.
It makes me want to quote Ian Malcolm a little bit there. Just because we can do something doesn't mean we should.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I said, it begs the precautionary principle because we can't recover from the. There's no way to clean up a spill.
So there's one. I'm gonna leave this with one last quote from him because we've got to move on. The other quote in there was the trouble with all this environment stuff. The trouble is that this stuff about Frankenfoods and putting poison in our foods. There are real benefits, and what you've got to do is sell the real environmental benefits. The last comment that I want to make on that before we move on is I think that the first part of that where he said putting poisons in foods. He said, you know, people are talking about putting poisons in foods, and that's not correct. You know, that's not what they're doing. That's just, you know, people who don't understand the science. I would flip it back at him. I would say he doesn't really understand the science. And the reason I would make that claim is because he's acting as if we know what all the poisons are. He's acting as if, because what we mean by poison, that's sort of an oversimplification, but a poison is simply something that is negatively, you know, not beneficial, the opposite of beneficial, something that's harmful, right? We don't know what all the possible genetic combinations of things that could make harmful things for humans are. He's acting as if we do. Like, he's acting as if he's making it sound like people who are anti-GM think that we're taking arsenic and putting arsenic in apples.
Right.
But we don't know what all the combinations of arsenic or other poisonous things. And that's just dealing with that one issue. You've also got the thing of how that replays off. You know, it's not just if it's poisonous to us. It's if it's poisonous to anything else in the entire ecosystem.
Right.
It's that it – and I think that's what's so dangerous about this is that the proponents of it think that all the opposition to it is uninformed.
Right.
Which is, and I'm sure there is some uninformed opposition. There's always informed and uninformed people. Well, hopefully there's always at least uninformed people on both sides of an issue, not
right.
necessarily informed. But in this case, it's sort of like they have the false arrogance of thinking they're the ones with the actual data.
Right.
And that's sort of what scares me. Anyway, unfortunately, we are going to have to move on. We're going to go now to an interview I did last week or a couple weeks ago with Andrew Reeks, again, the general manager of Patagonia Toronto. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We are speaking today to Andrea Reeks, the manager of Patagonia Toronto, and I'm speaking to her today because you were actually passed on to me by another friend who recommended that we take a look at you, and it seems like a very interesting company. So welcome to the Green Majority, Andrea. My first question for you is, I can't entirely tell from your website if you're an activism website, if you're a product manufacturer. There's a whole lot of stuff up there. So shall we just start off and just let the audience know what exactly is it that you do?
All right. Yes. Okay. We hear that a lot, actually. We make outdoor clothing, as well as some just regular clothing like blue jeans, t-shirts, that sort of thing. So that is what we do. And, our company, started out making climbing gear many, many years ago. We got into clothing and, as soon as we got into clothing, we definitely changed direction to focus on our impact that we had with where we were getting the clothing from and then how we were making it. And that kind of turned into something that is mostly what you see on the website, which is the environmental story behind the impact of all of that. And then realizing as a company that we needed to do something to change the way we were operating and hopefully inspire change amongst other businesses. And that's when we get into things like 1% for the planet and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a perfect spot to run off. So you are a product manufacturer, but you have obviously strong environmental leaning. So let's talk about some of the things that that are your products, and then you can tell me kind of as we go the sort of environmental considerations that you've taken.
You bet. One great example that we could get right into is things made with cotton. So back in the 90s, we were using industrial grown cotton. We came to realize in doing a lot of research with our supply chain that the effect on water that industrial grown cotton has is immense, and something that our founder and the guy who still owns our company, Yvonne Chouinard, decided he did not want to continue using if there wasn't a way to go about using a resource that wasn't going to damage the earth so much. And so he started looking at organic cotton and trying to figure out how to change all of our cotton to organic cotton, because he said we're going to stop making cotton clothing if we can't figure out how to lessen the impact. And by 1996, we were fully switched over to using organic cotton, decreasing our water footprint as well as the chemicals that are put into the watersheds and the places where we were making our cotton. And as the years went by, we started looking at it even further. How can we do better than just organic cotton? Can we recycle organic cotton? That's something we're working on right now. And also, where is this organic cotton grown? Is it grown in a place in Europe where a lot of water is irrigated and used to water that organic cotton? Or is it in a place like India where there's a lot of natural rainfall and we don't have to take from natural water resources? So we did some research and found out that it cost way more in water dollars, let's say, for us to make a t-shirt than it did to make a pair of blue jeans. And that was because we were making our jeans or getting our organic cotton for our jeans from India, where they have a whole lot of water, which is what cotton needs to grow. But we weren't taking it from people who actually need to drink it.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that we noticed when we were skimming your site as well was that some of your products you do have manufactured all over the world. The name of Patagonia itself, I'm assuming it comes from the piece there that it references, talking about a region in Chile and Argentina, which is a very diverse ecosystem that's there. You're trying to work with Conservation Patagonia to protect that area and create like a Yosemite Sam National Park type region around there.
Yeah.
But with that, I mean, there's so many decisions that you have to come to when you're making, when you're trying to operate a business. And one of them, of course, is that picked up one of my producer's eyes was that you did have some products that were made in China and Bangladesh and that sort of thing. And she was kind of like, oh, that, caught my eye. That doesn't seem, but then you've also gone into, we then discovered, of course, that you've also gone into fairly good detail about, we've chosen these specific suppliers for these specific reasons. And, it's, there's this and this and this, which could be seen as a negative, but here's a bunch of positives. I think you would probably be in a very, very good position to talk about the difficult decisions that come into play when you're trying to make an, ecologically and socially sustainably fair company based around ecologically and sociologically sustainable products, is that it's very, very hard to be perfect and you do have to make a lot of choices. Can you talk a little bit about some of those kind of give and takes?
You bet. So I don't know if you guys came across our mission in your exploration of the website, but mm-hmm. our mission is and has been from the get-go of the company is to build the best product, cause no unnecessary harm, use business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis. So we are driven by that in every single thing that we do. And that ends up with us asking a lot of questions of ourselves and how we do things internally as a company, for me here in the store, for our head office in Ventura, all the way out to how do all of our suppliers do business? How do they treat their people? And we get a lot of questions from customers that we're then, a lot of it is, it brings our attention to something someone might not have thought of. Mm-hmm. So then we dig deeper into that and ask more questions and find answers. We have no problem being transparent about when we're doing it wrong. we will give a press release about how we did something wrong and then how we're going to work to change it. And so we pay a lot of attention when we're choosing places to manufacture, choosing sources to get our down from for our jackets. So we learned that in trying to find some supplier that could provide us with the down that we needed, we wanted to make sure that they weren't live plucking because that wasn't acceptable to us. So we found a down source that was coming from geese that were used for food. So in our minds, we were like, this is great. It's not being live plucked. The birds are dead when we take the down off, and then the rest of them is being used for food. So this is great. This is a good way to utilize this animal. Mm-hmm. As we went along, we found out that some of the geese that we were taking the down from were actually being force-fed to make foie gras. That was not okay. And that came to us through an activist group, actually, in Europe. And they came to us, and we were like, holy cow, okay, let's dig into this and find a different source. And that was, I guess that was 2 years ago now. And mm-hmm. we've since began using different sources who are not live flocking and are not force feeding their animals. So it's stuff like that. We think that we've got an answer, and then someone asks another question, and we're like, you're right, we don't know. Let's look into that. So being mission-driven definitely gives us that touchstone to go back to all the time. And we know that we're not perfect. We're never going to be perfect, but we are trying to operate as though we're going to be around for 100 years or longer, if possible.
So I'm actually very, very interested in that aspect of it. When you're doing that, obviously it sounds like this has been a huge learning process, even for a group of people that sound like they were definitely aware of a lot of these issues and definitely passionate about these issues ahead of time, that there's been a lot of learning that's going on. What I'm curious of, based on that idea, is have you found, I mean, you gave me an example of somewhere where, you know, you thought you had a good answer and then you got more information and you found an even better answer. Have you come up against anything, and I don't know if you want to give me any examples if you can think of it, but of stuff where there really just was sort of no way around two evils and you just sort of had to grit your teeth and pick one?
Yeah, I think a good example of that would be the fact that in our technical clothing and in our fleeces and whatnot, we are using polyester and nylon. Those are petroleum-based products. They come from petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something in order for us to make the clothes that we want to make to get people outside, keep them warm and dry, we have to use this material in some way, shape, or form. So initially when we realized the impact of those materials, looking into how we can lessen that. So that brought us to our Common Threads initiative, and that began as recycling. So first we started making fleece out of recycled pop bottles. With PolarTech, and that we thought was a great answer. These bottles are being made anyhow. We will recycle it and turn it into clothing that can be used. Realizing after doing that for several years that wasn't good enough in our eyes, so we got into looking how to recycle the clothes that we make so that we could see it cradle to cradle.
Mm-hmm.
So we started taking back all of our fleece and recycling that, and then we incorporated every single thing that we make we now take back to recycle. So from the polyester and nylon side of things, we have that. We know how to recycle those components of our clothing. So they're usually a high percentage of the content of our clothing is made from something that used to be our clothing, which is pretty cool. But it still isn't 100% in everything, and that's what we would like to go for so that we aren't taking virgin petroleum out of the ground and pardon me, having that turned into polyester and nylon that we use for our clothing. We're also working with folks like Gore-Tex and, as I mentioned, PolarTech to come up with technologies that have less of an impact in making those technical fabrics. So that's something we don't have a perfect answer for, but we are always trying to innovate and come up with a better way to do things. And for us, keeping things out of landfill is something that we're highly focused on in reusing and asking people to reduce what they buy and only buying what they know they'll need and they know they can repair and they know they can hand down.
It sounds like not only a lot of the knowledge that you use to implement your business practices, but also the people who work there, sort of personal knowledge as well, is almost you've almost moved it to a crowdsourced business model, if I may. It sounds like where you seem very involved with, you know, even before there's an issue, before a customer's upset, you're actively looking for stuff, but you do take seriously people's criticisms from outside as well. That's a very uncommon business model. I'm not even sure what question to ask about it, but I guess, I mean, how have you found that, that has worked as opposed to sort of, you know, sitting in at the drawing board until you have kind of one set way and then, okay, this is the product, we're going to sell it this way. And then there's how we go. Has that made the doing business more difficult, even though it's maybe emotionally and ethically satisfying?
No, I guess difficult to the extent that we're constantly looking for new sources, for better ways to do things. But that's part of our mission, is to inspire other businesses to change. So if we're working in a manufacturing company overseas, and we see a better way to do something, and if we're getting enough supply out of that particular place, we can ask them to change the way that they're doing something. And most of the places that we work with do that. So we audit our suppliers and we audit our manufacturers for fair labor practices and for their environmental impact. And that's all part of actually something called benefit corporation status in the U.S. And then the B Corp certification, that is something that is happening, I believe, all over the world now. We have a bunch of B Corps here in Canada, as well as a ton throughout the U.S. And these benefit corporations are, they can be individuals working in any type of industry or privately held companies. They can try to attain benefit corporation status by being audited on everything from how they impact the community where they operate, how they impact their workers, the environment. And they focus on a triple bottom line, which is putting the planet, people, and profit all at the same level of importance in operating their business. So that, I believe, I know Patagonia as a company believes in that. That is the way that business has to change going forward if we all want to be around for a long time and have fresh water to drink and clean air to breathe.
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid we are out of time, but it's been my pleasure to have you on today. Andrea Reeks, the manager of Patagonia Toronto. Do you want to plug your website or something before you go?
Sure. You can find us on Facebook at Patagonia Toronto or at patagonia.com/CA.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take, that was the Green Majority. If you haven't been following along, I'm Darren Keister, your host. We are going to take a really brief music break, and then we'll be back. We're going to talk to Kevin a little bit more, and then we'll jump to our last feature. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. We are back. I'm Darren Keister. You're listening to The Green Majority. Just a couple of quick announcements, of course, as well. I just want to let people know, if you haven't checked out the website recently, you should really do that. We've done some updating. It looks a little bit shinier. I've got a nice hero slider at the top, what it's called. Got lots of fancy pictures. More content, music reviews from Amber Waves from Open to Midnight blog for all the tracks that you've been hearing. And lots more. We've also added a calendar, which is the announcement that I wanted to make sure I made today, where you can actually, if you use Google Calendars or you know anyone who's running an event, either something you are doing or just an event that you think that the Green Majority would be interested in, you can go ahead and actually post it on our calendar from your calendar in the Google Calendar from your Gmail account. And it will actually show up automatically. We don't need to approve it or anything, unless someone starts abusing that, and then I will make it so you have to approve it. But for the time being, you can go ahead and put it up there. And then we will respond and let you know whether or not we're able to come. And then if not, at the very least, anyone can actually add our calendar to their calendar and see all the Green Majority events, see all the public stuff that's going on. So we're trying to kind of create that as a resource. So please feel free. Any environmental events just in Toronto for now, because I don't have my own private jet just yet. If we can keep it to Toronto for now, but if you want to post any local events, could be anything, could be a small local meetup of a bunch of high school students, it could be a university event, it could be the annual shareholders meeting for environmental defense, whatever you got for us, no problem, just let us know what's going on there and we'll try and make it down, because I love going and actually meeting people in person. However, what I'm actually going to do, I said we were going to talk to Kevin, we're actually going to hold that to the end just to make sure we don't run out of time. I'm actually going to go to, just for my tech, which is track 5, we're going to play Jonathan Trent, Energy from Floating Algal Ponds. And then we'll come back and just talk about a fun story that was in the Toronto Star here by Christopher Hume, who's a local columnist, about some pedestrian death traffic. Because Kevin and I were talking about that just a little bit. And I think there's an interesting kind of story to be told there. However, for now, we're going to go ahead and listen again. This is Jonathan Trent. This is courtesy of TED Talks, Energy from Floating Algal Ponds. I think you'll really like this.
Some years ago, I set out to try to understand if there was a possibility to develop biofuels on a scale that would actually compete with fossil fuels, but not compete with agriculture for water, fertilizer, or land. So here's what I came up with. Imagine that we build an enclosure where we put it just underwater, and we fill it with wastewater and some form of microalgae that produces oil, and we make it out of some kind of flexible material that moves with waves underwater. And the system that we're going to build, of course, will use solar energy to grow the algae, and they use CO2, which is good, and they produce oxygen as they grow. The algae that grow are in a container that distributes the heat to the surrounding water, and you can harvest them and make biofuels and cosmetics and fertilizer and animal feed. And of course, you'd have to make a large area of this, so you'd have to worry about other stakeholders like fishermen and ships and such things. But hey, we're talking about biofuels, and we know the importance of potentially getting an alternative liquid fuel. Why are we talking about microalgae? Here you see a graph showing you the different types of crops that are being considered for making biofuels. So you can see some things like soybean, which makes 50 gallons per acre per year, or sunflower, or canola, or jatropha, or palm. And that tall graph there shows what microalgae can contribute. That is to say, microalgae contributes between 2,000 and 5,000 gallons per acre per year, compared to the 50 gallons per acre per year from soy. So what are microalgae? Microalgae are micro, that is, they're extremely small. As you can see here, a picture of those single-celled organisms compared to a human hair. Those small organisms have been around for millions of years, and there's thousands of different species of microalgae in the world, some of which are the fastest-growing plants on the planet and produce, as I just showed you, lots and lots of oil. Now, why do we want to do this offshore? Well, the reason we're doing this offshore is because if you look at our coastal cities, there isn't a choice. Because we're going to use wastewater, as I suggested, and if you look at where most of the wastewater treatment plants are, they're embedded in the cities. This is the city of San Francisco, which has 900 miles of sewer pipes under the city already, and it releases its wastewater offshore. So different cities around the world treat their wastewater differently. Some cities process it, some cities just release the water. But in all cases, the water that's released is perfectly adequate for growing microalgae. So let's envision what the system might look like. We call it OMEGA, which is an acronym for Offshore Membrane Enclosures for Growing Algae. And that's where you have to have good acronyms. So how does it work? I sort of showed you how it works already. We put wastewater and some source of CO2 into our floating structure, and the wastewater provides nutrients for the algae to grow, and they sequester CO2 that would otherwise go off into the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas. They, of course, use solar energy to grow, and the wave energy on the surface provides energy for mixing the algae, and the temperature is controlled by the surrounding water temperature. The algae that grow produce oxygen, as I've mentioned, and they also produce biofuels and fertilizer and food and other bioalgal products of interest. And the system is contained. What do I mean by that? It's modular. And let's say something happens that's totally unexpected to one of the modules. It leaks, struck by lightning. The wastewater that leaks out is the water that already now goes into that coastal environment. And the algae that leak out are biodegradable. And because they're living in wastewater, they're freshwater algae, which means they can't live in saltwater, so they die. The plastic we'll build it out of was some kind of well-known plastic that we have good experience with, and we'll rebuild our modules to be able to reuse them again. So we may be able to go beyond that when thinking about this system that I'm showing you, and that is to say we need to think in terms of the water, the fresh water, which is also going to be an issue in the future, and we're working on methods now for recovering the wastewater. The other thing to consider is the structure itself. It provides a surface for things in the ocean, and this surface, which is covered by seaweeds and other organisms in the ocean, will become enhanced marine habitat, so it increases biodiversity. And finally, because it's an offshore structure, we can think in terms of how it might contribute to an aquaculture activity offshore. So you're probably thinking, gee, this sounds like a good idea. What can we do to try to see if it's real? Well, I set up laboratories in Santa Cruz at the California Fish and Game Facility, and that facility allowed us to have big seawater tanks to test some of these ideas. We also set up experiments in San Francisco at one of the three wastewater treatment plants, again, a facility to test ideas. And finally, we wanted to see where we could look at what the impact of this structure would be in the marine environment, and we set up a field site at a place called Moss Landing Marine Lab in Monterey Bay, where we worked in a harbor to see what impact this would have on marine organisms. The laboratory that we set up in Santa Cruz was our skunk works. It was a place where we were growing algae and welding plastic and building tools and making a lot of mistakes. Or, as Edison said, we were finding the 10,000 ways that the system wouldn't work. Now, we grew algae in wastewater, and we built tools that allowed us to get into the lives of algae so that we could monitor the way they grow. What makes them happy? How do we make sure that we're going to have a culture that will survive and thrive? So the most important feature that we needed to develop were these so-called photobioreactors, or PBRs. These were the structures that will be floating at the surface made out of some inexpensive plastic material that will allow the algae to grow. And we built lots and lots of designs, most of which were horrible failures. And when we finally got to a design that worked at about 30 gallons, we scaled it up to 450 gallons in San Francisco. So let me show you how the system works. We basically take wastewater with algae of our choice in it, and we circulate it through this floating structure, this tubular, flexible plastic structure, and it circulates through this thing, and there's sunlight, of course, is at the surface, and the algae grow on the nutrients. But this is a bit like putting your head in a plastic bag. The algae are not going to suffocate because of CO2 as we would. They suffocate because they produce oxygen, and they don't really suffocate, but the oxygen that they produce is problematic, and they use up all the CO2. So the next thing we had to figure out was how we could remove the oxygen, which we did by building this column which circulated some of the water, and put back CO2, which we did by bubbling the system before we recirculated the water. And what you see here is the prototype, which was the first attempt at building this type of column, the larger column that we then installed in San Francisco and the installed system. So the column actually had another very nice feature, and that is the algae settle in the column. And this allowed us to accumulate the algal biomass in a context where we could easily harvest it. So we would remove the algae as it concentrated in the bottom of this column, and then we could harvest that by a procedure where you float the algae to the surface and can skim it off with a net. So we wanted to also investigate what would be the impact of this system in the marine environment. And I mentioned we set up this experiment at a field site in Moss Landing Marine Lab. Well, We found, of course, that this material became overgrown with algae, and we needed then to develop a cleaning procedure. And we also looked at how seabirds and marine mammals interacted. And in fact, you see here a sea otter that found this incredibly interesting and would periodically work its way across this little floating waterbed. And we wanted to hire this guy or train him to be able to clean the surface of these things, but that's for a future. Now, really what we were doing, we were working in four areas. Our research covered the biology of the system, which included studying the way algae grew, but also what eats the algae and what kills the algae. We did engineering to understand what we would need to be able to do to build this structure, not only on this small scale, but how we would build it on this enormous scale that will ultimately be required. I mentioned we looked at birds and marine mammals and looked at basically the environmental impact of the system. And finally, we looked at the economics. And what I mean by economics is, what is the energy required to run the system? Do you get more energy out of the system than you have to put into the system to be able to make the system run? And what about operating costs? And what about capital costs? And what about just the whole economic structure? So let me tell you that it's not going to be easy. And there's lots more work to do in all four of those areas to be able to really make the system work. But we don't have a lot of time. And I'd like to show you the artist's conception of how the system might look if we find ourselves in a protected bay somewhere in the world. And we have in the background in this image the wastewater treatment plant and a source of flue gas for the CO2. But when you do the economics of this system, you find that, in fact, it will be difficult to make it work. Unless you look at the system as a way to treat wastewater, sequester carbon, and potentially for photovoltaic panels or wave energy or even wind energy. And if you start thinking in terms of integrating all of these different activities, you could also include in such a facility aquaculture. So we would have under this system a shellfish aquaculture where we're growing mussels or scallops. We'd be growing oysters and things that would be producing high-value products and food. And this would be a market driver as we build the system to larger and larger scales so that it becomes ultimately competitive with the idea of doing it for fuels. So there's always a big question that comes up because plastic in the ocean has got a really bad reputation right now. And so we've been thinking cradle to cradle. What are we going to do with all this plastic that we're going to need to use in our marine environment? Well, I don't know if you know about this, but in California, there's a huge amount of plastic that's used in fields right now as plastic mulch. And this is plastic that's making these tiny little greenhouses right along the surface of the soil. And this provides warming the soil to increase the growing season. It allows us to control weeds. And, of course, it makes the watering much more efficient. So the Omega system will be part of this type of outcome, and that when we're finished using it in the marine environment, we'll be using it, hopefully, on fields. Where are we going to put this? And what will it look like offshore? Here's an image of what we could do in San Francisco Bay. San Francisco produces 65 million gallons a day of wastewater. If we imagine a five-day retention time for the system, we need 325 million gallons to accommodate, and that will be about 1,280 acres of these Omega modules floating in San Francisco Bay. Well, that's less than 1% of the surface area of the bay. It would produce, at 2,000 gallons per acre per year, it would produce over 2 million gallons of fuel, which is about 20% of the biodiesel or of the diesel that would be required in San Francisco. And that's without doing anything about efficiency. Where else could we potentially put this system? There's lots of possibilities. There's, of course, San Francisco Bay. As I mentioned, San Diego Bay is another example, Mobile Bay or Chesapeake Bay. But the reality is, as sea level rises, there's going to be lots and lots of new opportunities to consider. So what I'm telling you about is a system of integrated activities. Biofuels production is integrated with alternative energy, is integrated with aquaculture. I set out to find a pathway to innovative production of sustainable biofuels. And en route, I discovered that what's really required for sustainability is integration more than innovation. Long term, I have great faith in our collective and connected ingenuity. I think there is almost no limit to what we can accomplish if we're radically open and we don't care who gets the credit. Sustainable solutions for our future problems are going to be diverse and they're going to be many. I think we need to consider everything, everything from alpha to omega. Thank you.
All right, and that, of course, was Jonathan Trent, courtesy of TED Talks, Energy from Floating Algal Ponds. As I mentioned here, NASA's also giving away that technology for free. There's one more question on that tape that we're going to cut it, but the video will be available on the website afterwards, and you can always we're going to post it on the website, and you can also search for Jonathan Trent, Energy from Floating Algal Ponds, under TED Talks on YouTube if you'd like to see the rest of that as well, as I said, or you can check our website. Ken, we've only got about 4 minutes. I wanted to run one last thing quickly by you, which was an article written by a columnist in Toronto here with the Toronto Star. This was in the Toronto Star. Christopher Hume talking about vast amounts of traffic deaths by pedestrian, or sorry, rather, pedestrians killing cars. No, cars injuring or killing pedestrians. 9 were hit on one morning. We've had just an absolute flurry of it. But the reason this article was written was because police chief for Toronto, Bill Blair, was basically saying that pedestrians didn't do anything wrong, but basically suggesting, well, kind of shrugging and going, oh, well, you know, perhaps they could have written, worn lighter clothing or something. Christopher Hume's point, which I would like to get your comment on, was that this is similar to the argument that made the Toronto women who were sexually assaulted, perhaps should be careful about how they dress. Now, there's sort of a tangential way to get this to environment, but I think this is very important if we're trying to create a culture of not car-based cities that we can try and reduce fossil fuel use, open up other options to people. The head of police in Toronto telling pedestrians basically, well, you know, just I guess you're just going to have to be more careful, doesn't seem to be a step in the right direction. Comment.
Well, yeah, you've already sort of hit it on the head. It speaks to our obsession with car culture. You know, we like to satirize the Americans for being in love with their guns, but we're just as in love with our cars. And we accept as the cost of driving cars a number of pedestrian deaths every year greater than the number of deaths due to gunplay. And, you know, guns make news as front page news. There's guns and gangs task forces. You know, guns are considered some terrible scourge in society that has to be obliterated at all costs. But when more people die from being struck by vehicles, it's like, oh, well, you know, society has deemed that pedestrian deaths due to vehicular traffic is just wholly acceptable because that's how smitten we are with cars. We simply can't imagine living without cars, and so pedestrian deaths become just the cost of doing business. And I would say that there is about as much need in a city for a car as there is for a gun, which is none at all. And you know, the way forward is to create cities that aren't, you know, completely car accessible, but have superb public transit. And anyway, it just speaks to our love affair with the vehicle.
All right. So unfortunately, we are out of time. I'm going to leave you with one more quote from Christopher Hume from the article. In 2010, when 7 pedestrians were killed in 7 days, police responded by cracking down on jaywalkers at Fronton Bay. Anyway, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you much for joining me, co-host Kevin Farmer.
Thanks, Aaron.
And thank you very much as well to Monica Poydak as well for being my technician. That's all we have time for. Check out the website, greenmajority.com. Until next week, thanks for listening. .com, that was .ca, by the way.